Rabbi Yehuda Halpert, Parshas Kisavo, Congregation Rinat Yisrael. Thank you very much once again for Rabbi Halpert for taking me up on my hopeful email when I email him and say, can you please give another shiur? He gave one maybe only 6 weeks ago, if that much, and I really appreciate it. And without further ado.
Thank you very much to Howie. My pleasure to give another shiur, and thank you for organizing this on a weekly basis, which is a big undertaking. Is everyone here from the East Coast? Anyone here from Middle America? Good. I can make fun of Middle America. So, when you live on the East Coast, you kind of have this impression of the world as kind of, from a New Yorker's perspective, and maybe if you live on the West Coast, but there's this whole country in the middle, which the Bible Belt, which is arguably much more outwardly religious than we are on the coast, or at least than our secular neighbors are on the coast, for sure. And there are organizations out there, and you have in front of you some pictures, that felt very strongly that as you're driving down the street, not only should you see signs that say I-95 and Friendly's next right and McDonald's on the left, but that you should see the Ten Commandments and other religious statements, religious verses, psukim. What you have in front of you is just some random billboards from really across Middle America, and as is with these things, they have drum up some controversy. If you recall, there used to be a sign on 87 right by the rest stop on the way up to the Catskills that said Mincha Stop. And then there was a whole big fight. Was it separation of church and state? Because it was at a state rest stop, and ultimately it ended up coming down. Similarly, with these billboards, there's been fights, you know, freedom of expression versus separation of the powers, et cetera, et cetera. We go into whole constitutional law. But the notion of having biblical verses and religion out there on the billboards, on one hand, you drive, you know, you could kind of see both sides. You see, okay, maybe that's nice. Maybe people should be reminded on a regular basis. On the other hand, you're driving down I-80 at 85 miles an hour looking for the cops on the left and the right. I don't know if that's the time where you're going to have a religious epiphany. Is there any precedent for this type of public displays of religion, or really public statements, public verses on billboards? So if you look at this week's parsha, you have 8 psukim in front of you, which arguably, you know, there are a lot of different parshiot in the Chumash which are complex, but these 8 verses get tremendous discussion both in the Gemara, in the Bavli, in the Yerushalmi, back and forth in the Midrashim, because they are very difficult to parse. Not only are they difficult to parse here, they're difficult to parse in Sefer Yehoshua, where they seem to be described again. And there seem to be contradictions within these 8 psukim, and there seem to be contradictions between this description here and the description in Yehoshua. We're not going to deal tonight with that overall topic. That would probably be a course for almost a semester to really go through the different mafarshim's understanding of it. But at the very end of this back and forth, I think it's worth reading the psukim that lead up to the last pasuk, and then I'd like to spend time tonight together discussing the last pasuk in this section and trying to understand exactly what the last pasuk means. So we start off, we're told, Vayitzav Moshe v'ziknei Yisrael et ha'am l'mor, shmor et kol ha'mitzvah, asher anochi metzaveh eschem hayom. We get an introductory statement. Moshe and the Zekanim tell B'nai Yisrael, listen to the mitzvot. The Netziv and others ask, why do I need another introductory statement? We've already been introduced several times. Again, a topic for another day. And we're told, V'haya b'yom asher tavru et hayardein el ha'aretz asher Hashem alokecha notzein lach, v'hakemotza lacha banim gidolot v'sata osam basid. So you're going to come into the land of Israel, and you're going to build, or not build, you're going to v'hakemotza, you're going to establish, or set up large stones, and you're going to sata osam basid, you're going to plaster them. Somehow you're going to take some form of plaster, and you're going to smooth them, or do something with them. Pasuk gimel, v'chasavta alehen, and you're going to write on them. At Kol Divrei HaTorah Hazot Be'avrecha, when you pass over into the land, you're going to write the entire Torah on these rocks. Why? L'man Asher Tavor La'aretz Asher Hashem Elokecha Nosen Lacha Eretz Zavar Chala B'Dvash Kasher Diber Hashem Elokecha Kasher Diber Hashem Elokei Avosecha Lach. Again, this pasuk requires additional thought. Are you going to come in so that you can do this? Are you, by doing this, are you going to be able to stay in? Leman, so that. Not so clear exactly how to explain that, but somehow there, God very much wants you to do this. There's a linkage between doing this and being in the land of Israel. And now we're told again, Dalet, V'haya ba'avrechem es ha'yardin, when you pass over the Yardin, Takimu et ha'avanim ha'ela asher anochi metzaveh eschem hayom, you're going to set up these stones, Behar Ebal, Visata Osambasid. So it's repeated again. Now all of a sudden we're told it's at Har Ebal, and Visata Osambasid. Very repetitious. Uvanisa Sham Mizbeach La Hashem Elokecha. And now you're going to build a Mizbeach. Mizbach Avanim Lo Tanif Alehem Barzel. So there are stones, there's a Mizbeach. We got the regular rules about Mizbechot that you're not allowed to use metal when you're ewing the Mizbeach. Pasuk Vav, Avanim Shlemot Tivne. Es Mizbeach Hashem Elokecha, the Mizbeach has certain rules. V'halisa alav olos l'Hashem Elokecha, you're going to bring korbanot on the Mizbeach. V'zavachta shlamim v'achalta sham, you're going to be able to eat from those korbanot. V'samachta lifnei Hashem Elokecha. Okay, so you're going to build a Mizbeach, you're going to be offerings to God, there's going to be some type of sudas mitzvah. And now, to summarize, v'chasavta al ha'avanim, you're going to write on the stones. Which stones? Or, the original stones, or both, right? Not clear, right?
Is there a possibility that they set them up at the Yarmouth and then moved them to Harvey?
That's also possible. How many different? And then, kind of, when you start bringing in information from Sefer Yehoshua, there are lots of different possibilities. Which stones we're talking about? Where the stones were, and what they wrote on. But again, this I'm just pointing out as a possible discrepancy, something that requires further thought. V'chasavta al ha'avanim, you shall write on the stones, es kol divrei ha'torah hazot, ba'er heitev. You're going to write the Torah on the stones, ba'er heitev.
Even the writing,
you're saying, what does it mean to write on a stone?
No, it's an extensive amount to write.
Ah, how are you going to write that much? Excellent.
Especially if it's on plaster, on stone.
So we're beginning to hone in on some of the difficulties of this last pasuk, which is, this seems like a massive undertaking. How do you write on stone? What type of ksiva? We know that when it comes to stam, to the Sefer Torah, tefillin, mezuzahs, there are all sorts of rules when it comes to writing. What exactly can you write? How do you write it? Okay, v'chasavta al ha'avanim. But let's go to the end of the pasuk, and then we'll come back to those questions. Ba'er heitev. What does ba'er heitev mean? If I woke you up in the middle of the night, you tell me it's a commentary on the bottom of the Shulchan Aruch. What does ba'er heitev mean?
Good explanation.
Explain it well. Good explanation. Clearer. But
just a clear message.
A clear message. As a matter of fact, I didn't read the Hakdama to the Be'er Heitev, but I would not be surprised if the reason why the Be'er Heitev called his commentary the Be'er Heitev on the Shulchan Aruch is because what he effectively does is he summarizes the Shach and the Taz, some of the longer and more complicated commentaries on the Shulchan Aruch. The Be'er Heitev, he kind of sums it up. I'd have to go back and check. But that's generally what you would think Be'er Heitev means. If you look at Unkelus, on this pasuk we're told... So you're asking, wait a second, what is the sub? What's Ba'er Heitev? What's the subject of the Ba'er Heitev, right?
Or when the Torah says, well, that's what it said, I was going to say, when it says it's called Divrei HaTorah Zos, originally when we read it, we said the whole Torah, that's the way you consciously led us at least. And then now, maybe it means that this needs to be written on it, not all the entire Torah.
When you just to expand on that, you said this needs to be written on. What's the this?
What we're talking about here.
Ah, okay.
So what preceded this part?
What's the part? Oh, okay. So you're saying when we say, what is the immediately... Okay, so we have now... Excellent. In about 2 minutes, in the room right here, we have hinted at, touched on, began to excavate, basically... all the different machlokot, all the different debates amongst the Rishonim and the commentaries on these psukim. You've hit on the issues. When it says, I kind of led you, or I was intentionally ambiguous when I read it the first time, what does it mean when we say Divrei HaTorah? And what does it mean when we say Divrei HaTorah Hazot, this Torah? And does that somehow link to what we're writing? And does that somehow link to how we're going to write it? And does that somehow link to what rocks we're writing on? And maybe that all impacts what the words Ba'er Heitev mean. what, you know, what they're modifying, what they're going to explain. But let's go. We've raised a lot of issues, a lot of questions. Let's go step for a moment here. So Unklus on this pasuk chet says v'sichtov al, and you have the English underneath Unklus. This is not my English translation. This is it's actually available online in English. It's by a Christian scholar who's generally considered to be a very good translation of the Unklus into English. This one in particular, and then the translation on Targum Yonas Ben Oziel, which we'll get to in a moment, which was also by a Christian scholar, if you read them carefully, both have certain, I'll say, Christological, theological concepts which they attempt to put into Unklus, and there is many, many books and articles written on Unklus and the different Aramaic translations and how they were used by both Christians as well as by Jews to kind of rebut back and forth. But for the most part, this is a non-controversial pasuk, at least from a Jewish Judeo-Christian polemic issue. So I think that the translation is pretty kosher here. V'sichtov al avnaya, and you shall write upon the stones, yas kol piskame oraisa, all the words of this law, hada, kol piskame haraisa hada, this law, paresh ya'us. It's translated as distinctly, paresh distinctly, ya'us and is beautifully. Ya'us is the same word which is used when we're told v'rachel ha'isa yifas merev, yifas toar, we're told that she was ya'us, she was beautiful. So we're saying, what is, according to Unklus, what is beautiful? What is distinctly and beautiful? What do you think that means? The ktiva, right? The writing itself. Just like when you go to buy tefillin and you ask, the sofer shows you his ksav, he's showing off what a great calligrapher he is, how nice his penmanship is. And in fact, different parshiyos of tefillin and Sifrei Torah cost more or less depending on the skill, the writing of the sofer. So Unklus is telling us that the commandment was to write it, ba'er heitev, write it beautifully. Don't just kind of throw it on there, scribble it down, ba'er heitev, write it beautifully. Paresh ya'u, distinctly and beautifully. So each letter has to be properly spaced, and it has to be in a nice penmanship. So going to the how monumental the work is, you might have thought, well, maybe we're doing some kind of like, what are those, super calligraphy, micro calligraphy, where you get all of Sefer Shmos into a picture, and you have all. So no, we're not talking teeny tiny text, we're talking distinctly and beautifully. Targum Yonatan ben Uziel says similarly, the tichtivun al avnaya, you should write on the stones, yas kol piskome oraisa hada, katav chakik umifaresh. So he's saying slightly differently. Katav chakik, what's chakik? Engraved, right? So what was actually, how were they writing? According to Targum Yonatan, they weren't writing with a pen.
They were carving.
They were carving into stone, which makes sense. You're using a stone. You're going to carve into stone. Umefaresh mitakre bechad lishin umetargim b'shivin lishnin. What does that mean? So what the Targum Yonatan ben Uziel here is combining two things. Ba'er heitev, first of all, the ktav has to be beautiful. And now let me give you a little bit more detail as Targum Yonatan ben Uziel usually does, not as literal, but more detail, more fuller. It's a beautiful carving, which is what you do in stone. And now the word ba'er, when I asked you what ba'er generally means, everyone kind of said, well, it means to explain, it means to clarify, maybe summarize. Ba'er heitev. So he says, not only are you going to write it, but you're going to be mitargem. You're going to translate it into shivin lishnin. 70 languages. How many languages are there in the world? In the eyes of Chazal, when we talk about the languages of the world, we always talk about 70 languages. Google Translate only needed 70 languages in the Torah. Right? 70 languages is the code word for basically universal translation. So he says. So now all of a sudden we have expanded the commandment tremendously. Right? There is an obligation to write it, ba'er heitev, beautifully, carved, and translated. Does the translation have to be written?
I don't understand it is a poetry because we know like in the Talmud and Melech, you know, when they ask to translate to that,
Right. So why? If Talmai HaMelech asked for translation, here HaKadosh Baruch Hu is requiring translation. Why is that? So you're saying, wait a second. Whenever anyone pulls out the English Chumash or the Greek Chumash, or whenever we hear about translation, it's always perceived in a negative. Right? And all of a sudden, here, according to the Targum, it's being translated into 70 languages, and that's not a negative. In fact, that's actually a requirement. We'll get back to that. So, but clearly what he's saying is, it gets translated, not so clear, mitakre bechad lishin, umetargim b'shivin lishin. And I just point out as a quick aside here, there's a big debate. So at the end of the day, how many languages, let's assume you read it like literally. So according to Targum Yonasan ben Aziel, how many languages was it translated? How many copies did you have? So one possibility is that it was oral, right? That you wrote it in Hebrew and you had someone standing there translating it for 70. I guess that was his job. You came in, you gave him, dropped a quarter in the slot, and he just espoused all the whole Torah into 70 Lashonas. But is it 71 or is it 70? Is the Hebrew part of the 70? So that there are 70 languages in addition to Hebrew? I'm sorry, that there are 69 languages in addition to Hebrew? Or is it mitakre b'chad lishin, it's read in one language, i.e. the most important language, Hebrew, umetagim, and then it's translated into the other 70? So that's a big, if you're interested in that topic, there's a whole genre, a whole debate as to whether there are actually 71 languages, and when we talk about the 70 languages, that's the 70 besides for Hebrew, or really there are 70 languages, Hebrew is one and there are another 69. But let's leave that as an aside. The Gemara, yeah?
I guess the question, why does the they came from Egypt.
Right. Saying who needs the other 70?
Yeah, it was the purpose of Shabbat
Abim. Ah, okay, so now you're getting to another question. You're asking, I still want to know what the Pasuk says. You're already asking me why the Pasuk says what it says. It's a fair question, but let's hone in on what the Pasuk says, and then we'll discuss why the Pasuk says it. But that's your question, basically. You're saying, wait a second, you're telling me not only, you want to tell me to write it in Hebrew, okay, fine. Now you're telling me to write it in Hebrew and to explain it and to translate it into 70 languages. Who's reading it? Who understands those languages? Who's there? Why would you have to do that? All fair questions, and perhaps based on those questions, you will go back and redefine your understanding of what the Pasuk means, because maybe it doesn't make sense to say it that way, but let's hold off on that. So the Gemara in Sota, in a lengthy discussion of what of these eight psukim and what actually happened, and in the description in Sefer Yehoshua of what actually happened, the Gemara in Sota at the end says, "Va'achar kach heviu et ha'avanim," as was pointed out, maybe the stones were moved. "Achar kach heviu et ha'avanim," they brought the stones. "Ubanu et ha'mizbeach," and they built the mizbeach. "Besadu basid," and they plastered them over. "Bekatzvu,"
that means they're saying that is the mizbeach.
No, I believe according to this Gemara, they're saying it's two separate things, right? Because heviu et ha'avanim, and I'm sorry, there's a whole. There's a whole daf before. They brought the stones from the Yardane, and then they brought them to the place, i.e. Har Ebal. Ubanu et ha-mizbeach, they built the mizbeach out of different stones. Not the stones that they just brought, out of different stones. Vishadu besid. Okay, fair. I'm sure if you looked at the Mefarshim on the Gemara, perhaps there are other explanations, but that's certainly not Rashi's approach on the Gemara over there. Vishadu basid, and they plastered it over. Vikatzvu alav et kol divrei ha-Torah b'shivim lashon. Here, the Gemara is clear. Vikatzvu alav. They wrote it, right? There was a writing. Now, writing in this context, again, I think would also mean they carved it, they engraved it. But it wasn't oral. Right. There might have been an oral reading at some point in time, but there was actually a writing. And if you look at the Bechor Shor, he kind of sums up where we are. He says, one, Be'er Heitev, what does that mean? She'yuhu ha'otiyot nir'ot, so that the letters can be seen. V'nikra'ot Heitev, and they can be easily read. V'halashon Mifurash, and it's all kind of very accessible, very understandable. If there's an expression, which I think it's originally an expression, a Yiddish expression, I don't know if it translates so well into Hebrew. Basically, they're called Otziot Kiddush Levana, or Kiddush Levana letters. Now, what that means is, when you say Kiddush Levana on a Saturday night, we go outside, we have the little cards, and you go by the light over there, and everyone sits there, and you try to read it, and now everyone takes out their iPhone. I guess it's after Shabbos, you don't have your phone on you. But Otziot Kiddush, you know, Kiddush Levana Otziot, back in the old days, if you look at very old shuls in Europe, outside on the wall was Kiddush Levana, and it was in very large block letters, because the lighting was very poor, everyone was standing outside, so you had to write it in a way that was readable to people in little dark. So the expression, if you wanted to say to somebody, you wrote it in 18 font or, you know, 22 font, you said Kiddush Levana letters. That's basically what the Bechor Shor is saying here. He's saying that these letters were written, it wasn't in teeny tiny ksav, it was written in large letters so that everybody could see it. Clearly the goal was so that you could see the writing. That's one possibility.
It's not the, you know, the
straight
pasuk, but it's the message of the
thing. Right. So if you say that in the Bechor Shor, and I hear what you're saying, it's a little ambiguous what it means by Bahalashon Mifurash, and we'll see other achronim will get back to this. Let's leave it there. Okay, fine. Let's leave it there. Though at the end of the Bechor Shor, right. Let's read the Bechor Shor again inside. Sheyuhu ha'otiyot nirot, that the letters should be seen, v'nikraot heitev, and read well or read easily, v'halashon mifurash. It's slightly ambiguous what the words v'halashon mifurash mean. I think you can read it in the context that it's just a continuation as to the fact that it's easily readable, but perhaps it's leading open to interpretation what else it could mean, v'halashon mifurash. Then the Bechor Shor goes on and quotes the Gemara, v'rabosenu amru, it's also a Yerushalmi, she'b'shivim lashon nichtevu, is written in 70 languages. Why? She'me'eza am v'lashon shi'avo sham adam yuchal lahavin v'lomod. So that way, if anybody shows up, they can learn it. V'alzen ne'emar, and then he quotes a pasuk in Yeshayahu, v'hayu amim misravot sida, and there's a drasha over there that basically at the end of days, the nations who did not accept the Torah are going to get it, and it's going to be, well, how could you complain that we didn't keep the Torah? How could you complain we didn't keep the Zion mitzvahs? How are we supposed to know? And the answer is going to be, well, it was written over there. You should have known. And that's how the Gemara darshins, that's a whole sugya unto itself, what's going on over there, but clearly what's said is that it was written in 70 languages. That way everyone could understand it. So if we have it set up right here, we have a pasuk at the end here, which says, V'chasafta al havanim, you should write on the stones, et kol dibrei ha-Torah hazot ba'er heitev. And we've suggested that ba'er heitev either is referring to the letters themselves, the words should be written clearly and inscribed in a way that was easily readable, or there's a more expansive definition that it means it should be translated into 70 languages. If you flip over and you look at the Ramban says, Katafta alehen is called Divrei HaTorah HaZot, he quotes the Pasuk, Amar, Rav Avraham, this is the Ibn Ezra, B'Shem HaGaon, in the name of Asajah Gaon, Shekatzvu alehem minyan ha-mitzvot, kemo ha-ktuvot behalachot gidolot ke'ein azharot, v'tam be'er heitev ha-ktiva. What question were Rav Sadia Gaon and the Ibn Ezra bothered by? Ibn Ezra says, what did they write?
What's Divrei HaTorah?
Correct. What's Divrei HaTorah? When they said, you should write Divrei HaTorah, what's Divrei HaTorah? And what's forcing them to the interpretation that Divrei HaTorah is not from Bereishis until Einei Kol Yisrael, is not the entire Torah, is the question of, what a monumental job it would be to write the entire Torah on stone and translate it into 70 languages. And therefore, to deal with that problem, what are we going to do? We're going to limit what Divrei HaTorah HaZot means. And the suggestion which is given is that it doesn't really mean the whole Torah. It means representative of the Torah. What's representative of the whole Torah? Tayag mitzvot. And what he references here is Ke'en Azharot, We don't do it, Ashkenazim are not knowing this, but on Shavuos, there are many piyutim, many poetry added to the liturgy, added to davening, which are called azharot, and it's all sorts of different ways of getting also all the tayag mitzvot into like a paragraph or two paragraphs. So what you've done is you've kind of encapsulated all of Torah into this little package, and you say, okay, write that on a stone, translate that 70 times, and there you have it, you have the whole Torah. By the way, as an aside, I'll mention, and Shoshana's only heard this Dvar Torah about 50 times because it's one of my classics, do you stand or sit for Aseret HaDibros? In this shul, what do we do?
Stand
up. All kofrim. Right? According to the Rambam, you are all heretics. Are you telling me that there's one letter in the Torah that's more important than any other letter? How could you stand for the Aseret HaDibros? I mean, yeah, we call them the other, but they're no more important than any other letter in the Torah. How could you stand for the Aseret HaDibros? The Rambam says you absolutely cannot stand, you must sit. Now, but we all stand. So the answer is, but first the answer is, we don't all stand. Nowadays, at least kind of in the United States, certainly it's become very, very common that most people stand, but there are many shuls where not everyone stands. But if we all, according to all those shittas who do stand, and now actually if you don't stand, like you clap, and if you don't stand, people like throw stuff at you, and like, get up. So the answer is, well, encapsulated within the Aseret HaDibros is all Tayag Mitzvot. And again, Rav Saji Gaon, when he counts his minyan ha-mitzvot to get the 613, he builds them all into the Aseret HaDibros. And from the Aseret HaDibros, he kind of, there are headings and subheadings and sub-subheadings, and somehow out of the Aseret HaDibros, you get 613. So what you're saying is, I'm not standing for the Aseret HaDibros because this pasuk, Anochi Hashem Elokecha, is more important than any other pasuk. You're saying, I'm standing for Aseret HaDibros because that's representative of Kol HaTorah Kula. So just like I stand when we do Hagbah for the Torah, I can stand during the reading of the Aseret HaDibros for the Torah. Now, if you're a brisker and you can't, yeah.
Well, man, perhaps you could say you're really supposed to stand all the time, except it's some sort of a tercha. So the fachot you should stand during the service.
Okay. That's one approach. You're saying that really there's what to rely on, not to stand for the whole thing, but at least for this you're going to stand for this. So when you stand, so quasi according to that approach, what some people will do, and you probably haven't noticed it because they're doing it intentionally not to, that you don't notice it, is that right. So when the Aliyah is called, you have to know that the Aseret HaDibros is coming. You have to know that Az Yashir is a different discussion. People stand for Az Yashir also. Why is that allowed? But okay. You know it's coming. So at the beginning of the Aliyah, you stand. And then you can say, I was standing for the whole Aliyah. It's like a classic Yotze L'Kol HaDeah. So you're not Yotze Kornit, right? So that's, you might notice certain people are standing for the whole Aliyah who don't normally stand. But anyway, that's all consistent with this approach of Rav Saji Gaon of Ibn Ezra, that within the Aseret HaDibros, within Tayag Mitzvot, you have the Kol HaTorah Kula. So when the pasuk says "Vekatafta al ha'avanim," it's called "Divrei HaTorah Hazot." You should write the entire Torah. What does it mean? Not the entire five Sifrei Chumash, but rather just this shortened summary, Ba'er Heitev, and then you can write it. Ba'er Heitev, you can write it clearly. Haktivah, it should be written clearly. Then the Ramban says, as he usually often does, Rabbi Seinu Amru says, "B'Chazal say b'Shivim Lashon Umatzinu b'Sefer Tagai." Shahaita kol ha-Torah ha-ktuva b'hen mi-breishit ad le'enei kol Yisrael b'tageh v'ziyuneha. So, I'm not really qualified to talk about Sefer Tag, but what the Sefer is, it's a Sefer that talks about how you should write a Sefer Torah, and all the little crowns, and all the little letters, and everything. And in the Hakdama, in the introduction to the Sefer HaTag, it claims that it was written, that its explanation of all the letters was based on the Torah that was written on the Avanim. In the Hakdama of the Sefer, we don't know who wrote it, but in the Hakdama of that Sefer, it says that the Ktav in the Sefer is written based on the Ktav which was copied off of these stones. And he says, right, so he says, so according to that approach, what was written on the stones? Everything, the whole Torah. So now the Ramban scratches his head and says, V'yitakein Shahayu ha'avanim gedolot me'od. Said, I would think that they had some very big stones. And then the Ramban says, shahaya mimasa hanisim. Or it was miraculous. I said, okay, well, you can't argue with that. If it's miraculous, it's miraculous. Basically, the Ramban's troubled. He's saying, How could it be that all of Torah in 70 languages is written in that way? And the answer is, it can't be. It has to be a miracle. Either you had really big stones or it has to be a miracle. Interestingly enough, Rav David Zvi Hoffman, so he's in Germany in 1890, I'm not sure exactly when he died, but at a time when the Haskalah and scientific approaches to Chumash and to Jewish studies was on the rise. So a lot of his Sefer is responses to quote-unquote scientific attacks on the Torah. And one of the attacks on this whole approach was, well, that's impossible. So he quotes, he says, first of all, he says, Divei HaTorah, Lo pirish hakatuv lehejat ma yesh lichtov, as we've discussed. V'nechleku ha-meforshim b'davar, he says there's a big debate. Kemoshe hibanus da'asin lemala, and he talks about it someplace else. And then in parentheses he says, Kanig, I don't know who that is, b'perusho l'dvarim, on his commentary on Dvarim, me'ir al-kach, Shechuke Hammurabi. Who's that? Right. The Hammurabi codes, which are 232 Sifim paragraphs, Hakdama v'divrei siyum, nechukul kulam be'evin bazlat, like basalt stone, achak gedola, and 35 Sifim nechukul achareken. So he says, don't be so shocked that you could write it, because Hammurabi's code, that was pretty long. And where was that written? That was written on a stone. It was chiseled in stone. So if Hammurabi's code could be chiseled in stone, you could write the Torah in stone also. It's not so impossible. That being said, so let's skip to another source here for a moment. So there's a sefer called Safa LeNe'emanim. It's not really a sefer so much. It's kind of like a little pamphlet. It's written by Baruch HaLevi Epstein. Anyone know who that is? Right. That's the Torah Tamima. More famously known by his book, The Torah Tamima. He wrote this little pamphlet in defense of the Hebrew language. Why did the Hebrew language need to be defended? So he was a big proponent of Ivrit, of Hebrew. A lot of us send to schools that teach Ivrit be Ivrit. I think nowadays you don't have to fight very hard to defend the Hebrew language. A lot of us assume that the Hebrew language, of course, by definition, that's a core curriculum item. But at that period of time, the Hebrew language was being attacked on two sides. It was being attacked by those same, what I'll call them, Jewish academics who were translating everything into either German or English, but much more German, the Reform movement and other academics on one side. And it was being attacked on the right, which still kind of is, that the study of Hebrew was really a direct route to the Haskalah. And if you were studying diktuk and Hebrew and grammar, etc., you were really on your way to Haskalah, and you should be learning Gemara in Yiddish, and the Torah was given in Yiddish, and you should learn in Yiddish, and that's the way it's supposed to be. So he was a big defender of the Hebrew language, which sounds funny, but at that time it was a little bit more unique. And in that Sefer, he's attacking and saying, you should not translate Psukim into other languages. That's his attack. You should stop translating the Chumash, you should stop translating all the Psukim into foreign languages. And what he says is, so he says, well, but you're going to attack me and you're going to say, how can you say it's inappropriate to translate the Psukim into other languages? In fact, the Torah itself commands you to translate into 70 languages. So look what you have here in the source here. He says, Aval achi yedidi, ha'anam libach yitencha leha'amin hadvarim kipshutam. So he says, lest you think that it's appropriate to translate, because the pasuk says be'er heitav, and we know that we've said that means to translate into 70 languages. Lest you think that that's actually literally what it means. Shehu atka kol haTorah l'shivim l'shonot, that the entire Torah was translated into 70 languages. Alav neha mizbeach, on the stones of the mizbeach. And now, by the way, just as a note, see where he slips in there. He's saying that he thinks that it was written on the stones of the mizbeach, not on the other stones. But, you know, he throws that in. V'im ze od haita haktiva tama ubara. Not only was it was written clearly and, you know, completely. Tzayer b'nafshecha shetach v'hekefs. Think about it. Mizbeach v'ha'avanim ha'nivnim tocho v'savivo. Eich shelo tisha'er gadol arkam v'rachfam v'hekifam. How could it be that there was this monumental work of the entire Torah written in stone, translated into 70 languages, on these huge slabs of stone? You're talking like Mount Rushmore size here. He says, and it it didn't remain, and there's no memory of it. And even if you're going to say that we don't have it today in 2016 or in 1938 when he wrote the book, you would have thought that Josephus would have mentioned it. You would have thought that other people, at least earlier commentators, at least earlier historians would have mentioned it. How could it be that this doesn't exist? How could it be that there's no mention of it? Now, of course, that is one of the weakest arguments in all of archaeological biblical studies. The absence of evidence is not evidence to the absence of an event, right? The fact that we don't have it doesn't mean that it didn't exist. That being said, it's a decent, you know, question. You would have thought that somewhere someone would have said, wow, when you pass by the Yarden, you see this 5-mile writing of the Torah. So that's his question. He says, then he goes on, he says, even to write it one time would have taken a tremendous amount of time. So how could you say this? And then he goes on and he says, Yesh mehem sha'amru asher ulai rak aseres hadibros have. Maybe even if it was only the small writing. He says, even then you would have thought that someone would have said it. And furthermore, he's not happy with that because it says, kol divrei ha-Torah hazot, and he brings a whole bunch of proofs which we don't have time to go into, that kol divrei ha-Torah hazot means the Torah. So now he gives a fascinating explanation. Arguably, it's a big chiddush. If you flip over to the next column, he says, "Ki bichlal hamilim be'er heitev." The third line, "Lo yisavlu es hakavana lahatik et haTorah l'shivim lashon," doesn't really mean to translate it into 70 languages. "Ki alo hashorish be'er yunachal pirov livaer ulifaresh davar satum." Right, that's how we started this year. Be'er usually means to explain. So why would Ba'er mean to translate? Ba'er means to explain. So let's skip now. He says, second paragraph, Aval ha'emet ha'brura nirali ki ha'kavana Ba'er hitev b'shivim lashon kachi. Yeshna milot rabot b'torah shemikoram einam b'sfat ivrit rak mushalim imheim misafot acherot. So he drops a little bombshell there. He says, by the way, you should know many Hebrew words are not originally Hebrew, but they're actually from foreign languages. They're foreign languages which have been imported into the Hebrew. So that's a whole shiur for another day, how that happens. He brings a ton of sources, a ton of proofs in Chazal, Gemara in Sanhedrin, a Gemara in Brachos, one or two other Gemaras, where they say, the most famous one is the Totafot. Right? Rashi brings it down. The Totafot is actually a African word. Totafot, which means foreign African, and then it gets transported. So he says, within the Hebrew language, there are many foreign words, and what the Torah is telling you is, v'chasaptes divrei ha-Torah hazot be'er heitev, that as you are writing the Hebrew Torah on these stones, those words which are not originally Hebrew should be miforash, perhaps like what the Bechor Shur is hinting at, should be explained. So it's not just the entire Torah, but it's the entire Torah with little translations built in at certain points. The katafta alehenes kol divrei ha-Torah hazot, you should write the entire Torah, be'er heitev, with footnotes, and explain it where necessary so that it's clearly understood. Understood by who?
By the Jews.
Presumably by the Jews. But I think, and I'd like to end with this point, that gets us back to kind of really the first question, which is, what is going on here? Why do we need this huge billboard of the Torah on these stones? Who's reading it and who is it for? Should I throw that out to you? What are the possibilities? What? Why? Why would you do this?
It's like a declaration of independence. It's saying what the land is going to be about. It's like what are the values? And so anyone who goes in, whether they're
right. So the Meiri kind of says what you're saying, which is he says basically it's for everyone to know. And then the question that's asked is, well, wait a second. To be a perfectly good non-Jew, you don't have to keep the whole Torah. You only have to keep Zion mitzvos. And you can live in the land as a ger toshav. So the goal is not to have non-Jews come read this and say, I want to be Jewish, or explain to them, this is what you need to know, because you don't need to know all that. But perhaps, where is this located? It's kind of located on the border. It's like when you come into the town of Bergenfield, you know two things. one, you can't park on the street after 11, and two, the speed limit is, I don't remember because I don't keep the speed limit. Whatever, that sign, right when you come into Bergenfield. Every town has that. When you come into the town, you say, you're now entering the town of Teaneck, these are the rules. You're now entering the state of New York, no right turn on red, right? So you're at the border of the land, and here you have a declaration. These are the rules of the land. Maybe they apply to you, maybe they don't apply to you, but these are the rules that the land is ruled by. And if you're going to live here, you're going to be here, you want to know the rules of what's going on, here it all is. It's a perhaps it's a declaration. Not a declaration to Bnei Yisrael, but a declaration to the rest of the world that when you come in. Now, that being said, it could also be a declaration to Bnei Yisrael themselves, which is, it's not bad to have a constant reminder as to what your rules are supposed to be. I was talking about this with someone else, and they said, oh, you could easily see this come out turning into an Avodah Zarah, that you could have people come and worship, and it becomes like you start worshiping the stones instead of worshiping. I said, yeah, I said, but the stones themselves are telling you not to worship Avodah Zarah, so it would be weird to worship Avodah Zarah there. It's been done before.
That's the case why the
Well, in Yerushalayim, you had the Beis HaMikdash. Here you're out in the boonies. You need a reminder over here. Or when these were built, there was no Beis HaMikdash, but you wanted to... This was a stop. Perhaps this was a stopgap.
The Mizbeach.
The Mizbeach.
So it's a place where people come,
Right? So it would be interesting if people continued to come and worship there, then again it would make sense to have the Torah there, because then when you came and you worshipped, it would be a time when you could... I don't know, catch up, or review, or restate that these are the laws, these are the Torah. Not everyone had a little pocket Tanakh in their pocket. So we'll end here. The Mefarshim don't discuss the why here a lot. They discuss the what. I think we've seen a bunch of different possibilities as to what was written, how it was written, and who it was being directed towards. But on some level, it might not be that dissimilar from the desire to put the Aseres HaDibros up on the side of Route 95 as a constant statement, as a constant reminder that this is the Torah, these are the rules, you should live by them. No one's, when they're driving by at 65 miles an hour, able to read all 10, but having them there might be a nice reminder. As we go into Yamim Noraim, you know, we could all think that perhaps if we had similar stones planted in different parts of Teaneck, you know, perhaps we could have a constant reminder as well. Bring it up with the town council.
thank you.
Great, fantastic. I forgot. You press this now?